The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
We are making significant inroads in Secretary Clinton's lead, and we have, with your support coming here in Wisconsin, we have a path toward victory.
Voting for Bernie Sanders, making the middle class stronger economically.
The only guy that's really standing up for us, the average person, is Bernie Sanders.
The system is broken, and there's really only one candidate that will not try to go through incremental change. He'll try to make a lot of change at once. That's what I want to see. And we're gonna let it burn.
That is the very viral Bernie Sanders, who undoubtedly approved that message. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Bernie's Big Mo.
We have the momentum, and I think a lot of the superdelegates are now beginning to look at which Democratic candidate is in the best place to defeat Donald Trump. I think some of them are beginning to understand that it's Bernie Sanders.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has won decisive victories in Democratic caucuses in Washington State, Alaska, and Hawaii, winning 73, 82, and 71% of the votes, respectively. He scored real delegates, got legitimate media attention, and can claim momentum. But what do the Sanders numbers actually say about the chances he could overtake rival Hillary Clinton? Is this peak Bernie or Lord Sanders in an impregnable second-place castle? Farai Chidea, a senior writer at 538, says that second-place fortress is looking pretty secure right now.
First of all, obviously it's completely notable that, you know, he has strengthened his second place in the delegate count. So it's still a delegate game. And so Clinton is holding a delegate lead of, 1234 to 956 over Sanders, according to the Associated Press. And if you include superdelegates, Clinton has just over 1,700 delegates. It takes 2,383 delegates to be the Democratic nominee. So Sanders, it has really increased his standing as a second place, you know, candidate, but he's still in second place. And the thing is, what happened with these past weekend races is a continuation of a trend, which is that he's had a 10 caucus sweep over the past 10 caucuses. He does incredibly well in caucuses, and some people think that that's partly because of his style. The fact that he has passionate support, caucuses rely on people who are willing to stand on their feet, be persuasive. It's not just, it's kind of like 12 angry men. You know, it's more
the jury room.
Yeah, yeah, it's right. More, it's not like just walking into a ballot booth with your own silent thoughts. It's about, you know, politics is debate. And so Sanders has done incredibly well. But the delegate math and the question of superdelegates is still a big one. So Sanders is also now starting to float the argument that superdelegates should switch from Clinton to him, which is reminiscent of the 2008 race where Barack Obama was able to get some of the pledged delegates who were black members of the Congressional Black Caucus to switch support to him after pledging it to Clinton.
Well, it's an interesting comparison, because if you look at 2008, there was this discussion at this part of the campaign going forward to the convention of who's the stronger candidate, and should the party basically decide who's the stronger candidate and go with that stronger candidate. Then Barack Obama made it moot by getting a majority of the delegates.
Yeah.
Does Bernie Sanders, even if Hillary Clinton gets a majority of the delegates here, regardless of what the superdelegates do, can he make the argument that Hillary Clinton is a weak candidate to go up against the GOP challenger?
You know, there's a couple of different factors in that. First of all, you can make any argument you want in politics, as we can tell from this race. You can say the moon is made of green cheese, and we reporters will fact check that. But if you choose to say it, you can still say it. But I think that what is becoming increasingly troubling to some people who are hardcore Democrats is that there seems to be a drop off in a certain amount of civility, like even measurable by do Sanders and Clinton call each other to congratulate each other after victories? There seems to be a distancing process between the two campaigns who were so cordial before. And so I think if Sanders makes that argument, it's going to be a scorched earth policy argument. I'm not saying he shouldn't make it because I'm not in his campaign, but the Democratic Party may not be enthusiastic about that kind of argument.
Let's go broad then here. If Trump's the nominee, and if Bernie has to be shown the door, and Clinton maintains her huge majority with African Americans, and the Bernie Sanders supporters, who are largely white, stay home, this becomes a black versus white presidential election campaign with a Latino component in there. That's a very interesting issue.
Yeah, but I also think there's, for example, white women who are GOP-leaning but pro-choice, they may not vote. They may stay home, just based on my reporting and also based on some polling. So I think that there's some wild cards in there beyond just race.
The stay-home wild cards could hand it to either party. Farai Jadeh, senior writer at 538, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
After 4 years of covering the Clinton State Department, veteran BBC correspondent Kim Gaddis trailed the U.S. Secretary of State that logged the most travel miles in U.S. history. She wrote a book, The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power, back in 2013. And since September 2014, as Gaddis watched Clinton make the transition back to the campaign trail, she hit the trail herself, shadowing the candidate for the BBC, A Journey from Iowa to Hillary Clinton's intended destination, back to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Going into the election season already last year, before the primaries started, it was very interesting for me to make that transition from observing Hillary Clinton as a Secretary of State to watching her as a politician at rallies, at political events, and watch her transition back into the world of politics after the very sort of bitter campaign she waged on the presidential trail with President Obama in 2008. I don't think it was always that easy for her to find the right tone, the right demeanor. She is, as she has said herself, not necessarily a natural politician. I always say that she's more of a public servant than a politician, but obviously you have to campaign to get the job. It's also been very interesting for me to watch not just the Democratic race, but the race in general. You know, I wrote a piece for Foreign Policy magazine to talk about how watching this election unfold reminds me of politics in the Middle East, because you have the demagoguery of candidates like Donald Trump. You have the invocations of God that Ted Cruz resorts to often. It's very common in the region that I come from, the Middle East. He invoked God and the glory of God when he won Iowa and he took to the stage.
To God be the glory.
That sounds like English for Allahu Akbar, which is not just a rallying cry for jihadist militants. It's the equivalent of praise the Lord. People use it out of joy as well. So all in all, it's been a very interesting new aspect of my career covering this campaign trail, because I've really only covered the Middle East before and international affairs.
Did you predict Trump's rise? Did you sense that there was this ambient anger within the electorate that was looking for a home?
Well, I won't pretend that I predicted what so many pollsters and candidates within the establishment failed to see. But at some point at the end of last year, or at the very beginning of this year, I wrote a piece comparing and contrasting Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, because it was clear that there was something afoot, and that on the far left and the far right, there was real discontent and a search for something different, a voice that said things that hadn't been said before, a sense that the economy wasn't working yet for everybody, even though there has been great progress made. But I also had an interesting conversation in July of last year with the Clinton aide, who told me at the time that they saw this unfold. They saw Bernie Sanders as a potential serious challenge, and certainly at the beginning of the race. So already back in the summer of last year, I was hearing from the campaign that they expected they could possibly lose Iowa and New Hampshire, but that unlike 2008, they were ready for the long game. So she lost Iowa in 2008, but they didn't have a plan for what came after. And this time they came prepared. They were hoping they wouldn't have a tough race at the beginning in Iowa and New Hampshire. They were hoping that it would be a cakewalk for her, probably. But it has been a challenge, but their playbook has mostly delivered. So she won Iowa by a razor-thin margin, then she lost New Hampshire big, but then she went on to win in those firewall states that they had predicted would help her gain the momentum again.
Do you think that the primary process and the extended timing that the U.S. election requires bears on these dramas that can develop? Say, for example, Ted Cruz versus Donald Trump, which in Britain would be over in a matter of weeks.
You know, this is a huge country. This is not Britain. This is not my tiny Lebanon. This is not Canada. And I have often wondered, why does it take so long? And I'm sure some of the candidates, including Hillary Clinton, ask themselves that question as well. You know, it is one of the most grueling, time-consuming, tiring, exhausting thing to be on the campaign trail. But as I went from state to state, from Iowa to New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, Florida, you know, I would meet voters at political rallies who were coming to listen to the candidates because they were still undecided a day before the primary in their state. They wanted to see the candidate. They wanted to hear them speak. They wanted to almost touch them, to make up their mind a day before the vote. So if you want to replicate that across the country, you simply can't do it within a couple of months the way it's done in the UK or in other countries. It does mean that there's a lot of drama that can unfold. Candidates who are at the top of the polls a year before can completely drop off the face of the campaign, as we've seen with Jeb Bush, for example, who was supposed to be the favorite, and he's gone.
And money can't buy you love in 2016. That is for sure.
Well, but it can buy you a sustained effort to continue to woo voters, and that's what Bernie Sanders is benefiting from. He has such a huge grassroots backing. He has such amazing online fundraising that it is sustaining him. And it is a phenomenal campaign that he's been running, energizing young voters. Of course, the Clinton campaign likes to push back on the whole issue of the enthusiasm gap and says, you know, look, he can fill up big auditoriums and gather thousands of people to his rallies. But at the end of the day, she's getting the votes. She is ahead of him by about 2.5 million votes. He can't catch up really with the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, with superdelegates, although again, he would like to try to convince those superdelegates to switch sides if he gets a majority of pledged delegates. And so he can stay in the race until, you know, the last primaries in June.
Two things, and you've alluded to one of them at least. I mean, America has a very divided electorate at this stage. And you see it certainly in the style in which the Republicans are operating versus the Democrats. I mean, surely there's a legitimate division between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but yet there's something very polite and thoughtful and mm-hmm. issue-oriented about the Democrats, whereas the Republicans couldn't be more different. It's all rhetorical. What do you think that's going to mean once we get to the general election?
You know, there was a very interesting email in the thousands of emails that were made public from the Hillary Clinton correspondents at the State Department, where she basically says primaries appeal to the extremes, to the people on the extremes, particularly in the Republican Party. I've spoken to her pollster, Joel Benenson, and he said, look, you cannot extrapolate what you're seeing happen in the Republican primaries to the general election. There are a lot of people who are rightfully disappointed, angry, upset, who feel left out. But as, you know, some pundits and pollsters have been saying, there aren't enough angry white men to carry someone like Donald Trump to the White House. They will have to find a way to appeal to a more diverse, broad electorate. And so far, that hasn't happened. The polls show African Americans, Hispanic voters are very much opposed to Donald Trump in huge numbers. Now we're seeing polls about women overwhelmingly rejecting Donald Trump by 65%, if I'm not mistaken. Millennials are also very much against Donald Trump. All of those factors put any Democratic candidate at an advantage in the general election in November. The Democrats already start with several points of an advantage in a general election. And what you're seeing play out, I think, on the Republican side is very much an intra-Republican fight. It is not necessarily representative of the bigger mood in the country.
Kim Gottes, BBC correspondent covering Hillary Clinton's campaign and author of The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power. Kim, thanks so much.
Always great to be on.
I feel really, really sorry and sad because the people who died, they are really young and students they are.
Another brutal terrorist attack in Pakistan over the weekend, a school targeted in December of 2014, killing more than 140 young boy students in Peshawar, seemed to unite traditionally fractious Pakistan in the fight against the Taliban. This latest attack targeted Christians celebrating Easter in the city of Lahore, and mostly women and children were killed by a single suicide bomber. Mia Bloom is professor of communications at Georgia State University and author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. She joins me now. Welcome, Mia.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you think this particular targeting is reminiscent of the attack in Peshawar in 2014, sets new ground in terms of Christian-Muslim relations in Pakistan? And, of course, there's the suicide bombing issue as well.
Well, we've seen how the Pakistani Taliban has targeted children in the past. In other words, they've gone after schools, government schools, because these children were the sons and daughters of high-ranking members of the Pakistani government. But we've also seen this exact same group target Christian sites. And so they went after, a little over a year ago, there were suicide bombs at two different churches. And so the idea of targeting Christians and targeting children is something within their bailiwick.
So would you say that this particular faction of the Taliban is distinctive in some way? Do they have a particular power base that's different from the Pakistani Taliban?
They broke off in 2014, and they at some point started to make noises about pledging allegiance or bia to ISIS. They recoil that back a little bit, and so they just emphasize their support for ISIS. But I think that we've done research in Lahore, we've been to the Swat Valley and to Malakhand area where Malala Yousafzai was shot. This particular group is venal. They have absolutely no moral code. There is nothing that they will not do. We met 8-year-olds who had been trained to be suicide bombers. So they are manipulating children, they're kidnapping children. So they don't have a moral compunction against either attacking children or using children to attack others.
What would you say is the element of the relative prosperity of Lahore compared with other cities in Pakistan as making it more of a target here?
Well, Lahore is a very diverse city. It's very modern and very Western. And for the longest time, unlike Islamabad and other parts of Pakistan, Lahore was relatively safe, you know, by comparison. We've met lots of people in Lahore who are what we would consider to be, you know, very Westernized, very educated, very secular in many ways. And I think that extending their tentacles now beyond Islamabad, beyond the Malakhand and the Swat Valley is their attempt, at least, to demonstrate force, that they can get, you know, Lahoris, which, again, Lahore has, I think it's really quite shocking. Because of the diversity of Lahore's population, there are lots of minorities. There are 2 million Christians in Pakistan, many of whom are based in Lahore. And so it is generally, it's a genuine threat for them.
The school that was targeted in December of 2014 was an army military school, which was ostensibly training young boys to join the military. And so it was seen that the military was the target and that it was a response to a military offensive against the Taliban. Does this have any specific precursor that this might be retaliation for, or is this kind of an out-of-the-blue attack on a community, as you say, 2 million Christians in Pakistan?
Well, the army has stepped up its attacks against the Pakistani Taliban, and so they have been putting the pressure. This is not surprising. This has been going on since 2009, and in fact, the army has actually been quite successful. The problem is, of course, that they just need a handful of attacks to really shock and terrify the larger population. This is very similar to what we've seen. This particular offshoot of the Pakistani Taliban has been targeting Christians routinely since 2014. So there is a consistency in targeting Christians. And since the Pakistani Taliban has been targeting children, there is a consistency of targeting children. The group itself, Iman has said that they were going after adult Christian men. And yet when they targeted the park, they targeted the children's side of the park that had all the children's rides and seesaws and this area. So I don't believe for a second that they were trying to limit the attack to adult Christians.
Your book is called Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. Is the Christian component here, does it add to the allure? In other words, is it harder to get suicide bombers to go after Muslims? Is there something about Pakistani law that gives something of a green light to this kind of violence?
Well, at the same time that we've been seeing the attack against the park, there was an attack against a minister who was very, I guess, liberal. He was attacked for allowing a Christian woman to, I guess, in Pakistani law, defame the prophet. And so he was killed by a bodyguard. And so at the same time that Pakistanis have come forward in opposition to terrorism, what we've seen is we've seen another group of people who are celebrating the bodyguard who killed the minister. So there is something in Pakistan about sectarianism. One of the things that I put in the book, and this is again was a bit of a foil to a colleague of mine in Chicago that said it had, suicide terrorism had nothing to do with religion. We were seeing a metastasis of suicide terrorism as a tactic go from being against occupiers to being against other Muslims. And so it is not difficult to get organizations to attack Shia in Pakistan. The Ahmadiyya community is constantly targeted. And so the idea of attacking someone who is other than us, so you've now decided that liberal or secular or westernized Muslims who don't subscribe to their ideology can also be targeted. So they have absolutely no limits.
Blasphemy is a legal concept as well as an emotional concept, and it plays out in terrorism in Pakistan. Mia Bloom, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mia Bloom is professor of communications at Georgia State University, author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. To save the city, they had to destroy it. This is the grim reality people in Syria are absorbing as they cast their eyes over the largely destroyed ancient city of Palmyra today. Syrian troops, with the support of Russian airstrikes, successfully recaptured the ancient Roman city after nearly a year of occupation by the self-proclaimed Islamic State. In July of 2014, the Association for the Protection of Syrian Archaeology collected photographs of destruction at the Temple of Bel in Palmyra. That was even before ISIS captured the city in May of 2015. ISIS cared little for the pre-Islamic history of Palmyra, and as regime soldiers closed in, the Islamic State blew what remained of 2,000-year-old temples, arches, and tombs. Amr al-Azam is former director of science and conservation laboratories at the Department of Antiquities in Syria. Now he is an associate professor at Shawnee State University in Ohio and identifies as a member of the Syrian opposition. He's heartbroken by what he has seen.
Well, obviously, Palmyra has strategic importance for both ISIS and the regime. It straddles an important crossroads. From there, you can take the highway straight to Deir ez-Zor, which counts as an important supply line for ISIS and would be an important route that the regime would like to take back if they are able to then advance onto the city of Deir ez-Zor and relieve their besieged enclave over there. It also, from there, you can also head towards the Iraqi border. And again, the loss of Palmyra for ISIS means that they've now lost access to that end of the Iraqi border as well.
In terms of antiquities, I remember the destruction of the Mostar Bridge during the Balkans conflict and how demoralizing that was. And it's been rebuilt, but nevertheless, an irreparable loss. What's your assessment of that?
Obviously, you know, the loss of the iconic monuments at Palmyra, such as the Temple of Bel, the Arch of the Triumph, the funerary towers, the Temple of Baal Shamin, all of these are really important and very iconic and highly recognizable buildings in Palmyra. And particularly in the case of the Temple of Bel, I don't think, you know, just from the early photos that we've just recently seen, I don't think there's any possibility of actually reconstructing that from the original stone. And it's probably, if any reconstruction takes place, it will have to be primarily with new material. And whilst you may get something up there, it will not be the same.
You're someone who we've spoken with on many occasions about the humanitarian disaster in Syria. I know that this antiquities domain is also very, very important to you. Help me to understand emotionally what you're going through in balancing and combining both of these losses.
Look, there's this binary that seems to be out there that somehow you have to care about one or the other. And you know, most people say to you, well, how can you care about stones and buildings and monuments when there's this terrible humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding before your very eyes? And for me, I mean, personally, I reject this binary. I don't think it's accurate at all. I think if you care about the Syrian people, if you care about the humanitarian catastrophe, then you also have to care about the history that goes with these people and represents these people. And to somehow suggest that there is no connection between the two is wrong. People without their history are lost people. And in the same way that this cultural heritage without the people it represents, it's just dead, inanimate stones that might as well just sit in a museum and mean nothing. So the two are very intricate, you know, very, very closely linked, and I think will play a very important role in the future once this conflict ends, and it will end one day, and people are going to want to look at common denominators that they can reach across and try to find some way of reconciling their differences, and this shared common history will, I think, prove to be very valuable in that.
Amar al-Azam is an associate professor at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Is Saudi Arabia heading for an unraveling like nothing we've ever seen before? It has been pumping oil and acquiring market share in the energy business, but at an enormous cost to the social programs and subsidies that keep the middle class in Saudi Arabia contented. Saudi society has also been fighting a curious religious dispute between educated secularized Saudis and the official doctrine of Islam in the kingdom, Wahhabism. Since the Arab Spring, a growing underground network of dissidents have been recording the cruelties of the country's oppressive regime, despite a very real risk of imprisonment or death. Dissidents with names like Sheikh Nimer and his son Ali, both on death row. And there's 19-year-old Yasser, a dissident we will speak about in just a moment. They all represent voices growing in their criticism of a regime facing increased economic instability and a brutal growing desperation. It's believed that at current rates of spending, Saudi Arabia will exhaust its foreign exchange currency in 5 years, and more people were executed in Saudi Arabia in 2015 than ever before, a total of 76 so far just this year, oftentimes publicly. Reporter James Jones directed the film Saudi Arabia Uncovered, a new documentary from PBS Frontline, produced by our partner WGBH. He says the unusual good fortune for the kingdom regarding oil has served to distort everything about its politics and sense of political reform.
So, you know, the economy isn't well balanced. So, you know, people are underemployed, if not unemployed, which is one of the factors in this kind of perfect storm of problems that's coming to Saudi Arabia at the moment. There's a lot of, it's a very young population, lots of people, the majority under 30, and they don't have, I think many of them feel unfulfilled, which is why some of them go off to join extremist groups abroad. Some of them struggle to express their dissent at home.
How does someone like Yasser get his word out, get his message out? How does he even function in the society?
With great difficulty. Just last week, someone was jailed for 5 years for sending a tweet. You know, this is not a place that tolerates dissent in any form.
How old is Yasser?
He's 19.
And tell me about him. Tell me a little bit about him.
So he's a university student. He's a Sunni. And he, you know, at the time of the Arab Spring, like many people in the region, kind of saw what was happening. You know, people hitting the streets, calling for democracy. And it was incredible. It was kind of inspiring. And that's all kind of come to nothing.
The regime basically shuts down opposition. It imprisons them, attacks them. I don't think this is Islam. All the people are angry, but the problem is that they can't speak and everyone is scared of being imprisoned.
And listen to this other comment from Yasser. And again, you've had to disguise the voice, which is a feature of this, which adds to this sense of being in another world entirely.
In Saudi, they say, be careful. The walls can hear. These walls can hear. Fear has taken over the entire population, from the elderly to young children. The regime wants to keep everything secret. If the truth comes out, it will be beginning of the end for them.
Why does he believe that? If the truth comes out, it will be the beginning of the end.
I mean, he's potentially overly optimistic about that. I mean, it's really hard to get a sense of how much of the population share Yasser's unhappiness with the regime. I think it's a fair bet that it is a pretty conservative country and the rulers are for the most part, quite popular, not least because they control the media. But there is this generation of young activists like Yasser who are more informed about the outside world, you know, through the internet and all the rest of it. I think they genuinely think that if they can show Saudis what the kind of brutal end of the regime, it will have an effect. And I know for a fact that lots of the activists, including Yasser, are really happy with the film because it goes some way to showing, you know, the reality there.
Describe the sense of public executions, the idea that you can be dragged into the middle of a public square and executed, and the regime will use you as an example. That's not some fantasy.
There are some clips in the film that are really brutal and shocking. You know, there's one of a woman being pinned down on the side of the street by police officers and is screaming, "I didn't do it." She's been convicted of murdering her stepdaughter. And then the executioner brings down the sword. Most executions are carried out with one sword blow to the neck. And it is brutal and it is frightening and chilling and it has the desired effect on the population. What's weird is that they want to do them publicly, but increasingly they're being forced to do them privately because people have mobile phones and they're capturing these moments. And Saudi Arabia doesn't like to be lectured on human rights by the world. So it doesn't like the idea of these images getting out to the world.
Did you encounter the religious guidance police, the folks who make sure everyone's covered?
We did, yeah. I mean, they're everywhere, you know, hanging outside Starbucks, making sure people go and pray. It's just, you know, it does feel like a police state. There's this kind of constant presence and menace, I'd say.
And there's no sense of feeling closer to God from all of these demands for piety.
It's hard for me to say. I mean, you know, I think certainly they are genuine in their belief that what they're doing is enforcing God's will. But yeah, to an outsider, it feels quite oppressive, yeah.
If you spend time with, you know, the Taliban in places like Afghanistan, there's often a kind of ideological passion and fervor in the intensity with which they enforce their brutality and piety. Did you find that in Saudi Arabia, or is there a sense of grim, we're just going through the motions here, and eventually it's either going to blow up or maybe someone will just write me a check and I'll shut up?
I think certainly the activists would say that religion is used as a tool to control the population. I think it is a genuinely conservative country, and majority of people probably do follow those strict Islamic rules. But certainly the activists felt that some of the rulers saw it just as a way to kind of keep people in line.
What do you think American policymakers will take from this film?
I think a lot of it will be familiar to American policymakers, but I think seeing it presented in such a stark light, particularly at a time when Obama is going to meet King Salman next month, you know, I think it should. And President Obama in the past has expressed serious concerns with human rights issues within Saudi Arabia, women, suppression of dissent. So I think that it potentially will strike a chord with people within the administration.
James Jones, frontline producer of Saudi Arabia Uncovered, airs tomorrow on PBS.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper.
It was more than talk about a revolution a century ago here in America that helped sustain the momentum of the movement that led to the independence of Ireland from Britain. Irish Americans kept the flames going, even though on Easter Monday 1916, when a small band of Irish nationalists seized control of key locations in Dublin and declared the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland, they were brutally suppressed by the British Army within a week. Thousands were imprisoned, and all seven signatories of the proclamation, as well as 11 other rebel leaders, were executed by firing squad. But five of the seven signatories were well known in the Irish enclaves of New York City, Hell's Kitchen, and Brooklyn, and their deaths germinated a movement.
The centrality of Irish America, and Irish New York in particular, I suppose, the centrality of that to the rising is now absolutely established. No New York, no Irish America, no rising. Simple as that.
Professor Jolie teaches Irish studies at New York University. He's the director of NYU's Glucksman Ireland House. And according to Lee, more important than Irish New York money, guns, and militant ideology was the very American notion that a free Ireland was a right granted by God, just like in the U.S. Declaration of Independence.
Virtually all the visitors from Ireland, including the rebels, the prominent rebels of 1916, could feel themselves in a freer atmosphere, frankly, and in a more supportive atmosphere. Because remember, at home in Ireland, the bulk of public opinion didn't think there was the slightest chance of a fight for freedom, shall we say. The idea that you could challenge Britain, you know, one of the world's greatest powers, was just crazy as far as they were concerned. Irish America had no inhibitions about that because I think they shared the American view that nothing Americans can't do.
John Cotter is a second and third generation Irish American New Yorker whose father was a beat cop in Manhattan and grandfather the proprietor of a small Irish pub on West 42nd Street. When asked about the importance of the centenary, he was unequivocal.
We feel here in New York, as the Irish are, very proud in Ireland and Irishmen all over the world, that this is a very exciting, you know, celebration coming up next month, because this is who we are as Irish. We achieved the dream of a free Ireland.
The U.S. has been trying to export its revolutionary spirit from the moment the British withdrew from the Revolutionary War, but it hasn't always been a very successful mission. Even in the Easter Rising, the message is complex. Given the violence, Colm Tobin, the critically acclaimed Irish author, and Irene and Sidney B. Silverman, professor of the humanities at Columbia University here in New York, says it's a cautious lesson of cross-ocean solidarity.
The project in Ireland, I suppose over the last year as we've been preparing for this, is to complicate the narrative so that words like proud are not words that come easily. Really, the general way is to try and understand what happened and how it happened and to get a sense or an understanding of it. But I don't use words like proud about anything. Even. I'm not sure about proud. It's the word I'm not sure about.
Tobin is sure that his grandfather Patrick fought and endured a month-long imprisonment in Wales for his enthusiastic participation in the events of April 1916. Tobin's aunt Kathleen, who lived to be 98, remembered the morning her father left to join the Fenians in Dublin and shared the memory with Colm as a young child.
The story also of him going in the morning, the week of the rising, into the boys' bedroom where my father and my uncles were sleeping, and digging up the floorboard of the bedroom. Just imagine this. The boys watching from the bed what he was doing. He was finding his rifle. And he disappeared then. And when there was a surrender, he came home. And then a day later, he was dragged out of the house.
What stands out to a poet and novelist looking back on his childhood in those days is the chaos which inspired an uprising and even a crime wave that Tobin can smile about.
Oh, the looters. The poor people of the tenements realized there was a golden opportunity to go down, smash windows and take things home, including fur coats. And they're part of my 1916 as much as any group of rebels.
You might say that's the Irish people all over. They treat a joke as a serious thing and a serious thing as a joke, in the words of Sean O'Casey. Next month's conferences at NYU are specifically on Irish America's role in the rising, a somber look at a moment when the uncertain feeling about a home left behind became a clear mission by the Irish in America to make a mark across the sea. James Keenahan is the proprietor of Kitty Kiernan's Pub in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and for him, the feeling is stronger than ever.
I've been here 30 years, and when I came to this country, I think 280,000 Irish people came around the same time. And each one of us seems to get a great welcome from the Americans, especially in New York. I don't know, maybe they feel connected to us or we're connected to them, as most of them are probably our ancestors anyway. But it's amazing that they always, always welcome us. And they never seem to get tired of welcoming us, which is a great thing as well, you know.
So what does it really mean to be Irish or Irish-American even? Do you have to read Yeats and suffer through Finnegan's Wake? Do you have to be a baptized and practicing Catholic? Even the signatories of the proclamation weren't uniformly Irish. Tom Clark was born in a British Army barracks on the Isle of Wight. James Connolly from an Irish tenement in Edinburgh. Kathy Burke Lord, an Irish-American who grew up in Bay Ridge, says that feeling of freedom's embrace sheltering the old country from far away is still strong. She felt it when she set foot on Irish soil for the very first time last month.
I just felt right at home, right from the beginning.
Irish requires no translation. To the Irish.
The sense of humor. They just seem to have a very quick wit, just very hospitable, and things I grew up with. And maybe that's what made me feel so at home, was so comfortable there, is just almost like, you know, like my people, if that doesn't sound too corny.
I have a life halfway across the sea.
Your life here could be just as good.
If you go back, I have nobody.
I want you to stay here with me.
100 years ago, the Irish Americans cast a spell of freedom on their brothers and sisters across the ocean. Just like in last year's romantic movie, Brooklyn, based on Colm Tobin's book about the U.S.-Irish connection, that magic is still strong today in the hearts of lovers and in the memories of people who understand the political significance of a moment 100 years ago called the Easter Rising.
Where are we going?
And here's one more thing to take with you. We note the passing of one of the great American writers of our time. Jim Harrison wrote with a reverence and passion about the American West and the soul of this nation's embodiment in land and the brash aspirations of its citizens. His book, Legends of the Fall, became a Brad Pitt movie. He had numerous screen credits, constant comparisons to Faulkner and Hemingway, started writing after a school altercation when a neighborhood girl blinded him in the left eye with a broken glass bottle at the age of 7. He wrote what he saw and experienced, from Michigan to Montana to Patagonia and Arizona, where he died. "I like grit. I like love and death," he wrote. "I'm tired of irony. A lot of good fiction is sentimental. The novelist who refuses sentiment refuses the full spectrum of human behavior, and then he just dries up. I would rather give full vent to all human loves and disappointments and take a chance on being corny than die a smartass." Jim Harrison, dead at 89. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.